Conversas Astronómicas.
Bom, sejam bem-vindos então a mais umas Conversas Astronómicas. Hoje estamos com três investigadores do Instituto de Astrofísica e Ciências do Espaço, Vardan Adibekian, Sérgio Sousa e Susana Barros, que nos vão falar um bocadinho sobre um exoplaneta um tanto ao quanto estranho. O resto da nossa conversa vai ser em inglês. O Vardan já é português, mas o português dele ainda não é perfeito para fazer este tipo de entrevistas e, portanto, preferimos fazê-la em inglês. So, I'll switch to English. Welcome, Susana, Sérgio, Vardan. Let's start with those basic questions about where are you from? Why did you decide to be an astronomer? In the case of Susana and Sergio, why did you choose the University of Porto?
So since I was very young, I like all the sciences. And at some point I discovered astronomy. I think I was 14 around this age and I got the telescope. Before that, I had a microscope. So I went through lots of sciences. And when I reached astronomy, I stopped searching because I thought I found what I really wanted to do with my life. There's lots of questions to answer, so I was caught by astronomy. Then when I started my undergraduate degree, the only course in astronomy was here in Porto. And so I came here, and I am from Porto, so it was easy. I could stay in my parents' house for the university. And then I did a PhD outside. I went to the UK and I was in Northern Ireland for postdocs. I was away for a few years, 12 years or something like that. And then I came back to Porto, not just because it is my town, but also because of the amount of instruments and missions that we are involved here in Porto. It's a great opportunity to work with so many state-of-the-art instruments. It's a very good place for me to be at the moment.
Sérgio?
So I'm from Vila Nova de Gaia, so just crossing the river. Why I chose astronomy, it was also a bit, in my case, it was a bit by chance. Before I went to the university, I look at my best class and I was good at mathematics and physics. And then there was this degree that also has in between brackets astronomy, and I liked the sound of it. I like the sky, so it sounded good for me. And that's why I came here. And also I didn't have the financial capabilities to go further away from here, this region in Porto, so everything was clear to me, this is what I should go from now on. And then I did everything basically in Porto and in Portugal. So I do the degree, the bachelor, the master's and the PhD. And then I did a postdoc, which was mostly also in Portugal, but also in the Canary Islands, in IAC, in the Instituto of Astrofísica in Canaries. And now I'm still in Porto, which is a very good place to be in terms of astrophysics. Although we don't have our own instruments, we have access to the best instruments in the world through ISU. And we can do really the best thing that everyone can do in our planet.
Okay, Vardan.
Boa tarde. So I will speak in English as the others. So I came from Armenia, where I did my PhD in 2009, and I was working on extragalactic objects because historically this is one of the directions in astronomy that we used to work most. But in 2010, when the head of exoplanet group in Porto, Nuno Santos, was in Armenia to receive a prize named after Victor Ambartsumian in 2010, International Prize, I met him and we discussed about the possibility of me moving to exoplanet sciences, which I consider that as a very good opportunity. And I applied for an FCT contract and I was lucky. And I'm very happy I joined the group of Nuno. Yeah, and then in 2011, I came here. And I'm very happy because this was in the exoplanet research, this is one of the really most recognized groups, I would say.
So I think a question that many of our listeners ask is astronomer or astrophysicist?
I think there is a difference, but the difference seems to be different in different countries. What I learned that astrophysics is part of astronomy. Astronomy is a bit more general than astrophysicist. And I always had a bit of impression that astrophysicists are those who do a bit more theoretical work. Maybe that's not absolutely true, but that's the impression that I always had in my mind. But I'm very happy with both of them. As long as I'm not called astrologist, I'm happy.
What exactly is your research subject right now?
At the moment, I'm involved in, let's say, two different subjects. They are very connected. One of them is measuring the composition of planets, and this is with both Cheops and Espresso. We also use HARPS. This work that we came here to speak about is one of the examples of what I do for my research. And another one is also with Cheops, and is looking for rings and moons and the interaction between the planet and the star that makes the planet deformed and also fall into the star eventually. And we want to see when the planet starts falling into the star.
Okay, so my expertise is more connected with the planet host stars. So I have developed several techniques to characterize the host stars using spectra and other techniques. I'm now working a lot also in the planet detection because I'm involved deeply in the development of instrumentation. So I contributed to the development of Espresso, where I was in charge of also doing some software for the Espresso instrument. So it's part of the instrument that is now in the VLT operating. I was doing the data analysis software, taking advantage of my expertise also to analyze and to extract information to characterize planet host stars. And I'm more deeply involved in the Cheops mission. So I'm working in different places in this mission from the development also. I'm working also finalizing the data, the pipeline that does the reduction of the observations on these satellites. And now I'm trying to move on to the analysis of this data, which is transits. So we get the light curve of the planet host stars, and while the planet passes in front of the light, some of the light is blocked, and so we have to analyze this light so we can measure the size of these planets. And the good thing about being involved in these two projects is that we can have access to two important fundamental characteristics of the planets. So with Cheops and transits, we get the size of the planets, and with Espresso, we can get the mass of the planets. Together, we have the density, so we can tell if they are rocky like Earth or if they are gaseous like the Jupiter's like planets that we have.
I joined the group of Nuno, the exoplanet group, but now I work mostly on chemical composition of stars with and without planets. Then try to understand around which stars planets form in the galaxy, because the stars formed different times and different places in the galaxy have different chemical composition. And planets formed around stars with different compositions are expected to have also different composition as well. So this is a way to understand where in the galaxy and when in the galaxy the planet formation was most efficient. And also, in a way, this will help us to understand around which stars we can look for planets like Earth to be habitable. So I mostly work on the composition of planet host and non-host stars.
Most people imagine astronomers working all night, looking through a telescope, but the reality is a bit different. So how do you describe a typical workday?
We don't look at the whole of the telescope. We look at the monitors, but this doesn't make the observations less interesting or less important. If you know how much costs one night of observation in these telescopes, 80,000 of euros one night. So this is a very important work that we do. We do observations, but during the night. And during the day, we use mostly computers or papers and pencils to write down the equations.
The normal day of an astronomer tends to change as you evolve in your career. So as first, as a student, you just have to face with problems that your supervisor tells you to resolve. And you are very focused on solving these problems. It can be technical problems. It can be simple physical problems for you to understand the physics behind the exoplanet. And then as you start evolving the career, you start to receive more emails. So right now I pass more time answering and reading emails and also trying to keep up to date with the current works. So we have to be up to date with the current. There's a lot of people doing research in astrophysics and in particular in exoplanets. It's a very strong field and it's evolving very fast. So it's very important to be up to date. So the normal day tends to change. So I'm glad when I have to go to the telescope and spend 1 week alone in the desert with the telescope. I don't have to pay so much attention to the emails and pay too much more attention to the telescope. So you have a bit more time to be relaxed.
I agree with Sergio. It changes a lot. And now with this COVID situation, it also changed to continue working. And we end up having a lot of telecons. I think maybe one stuff that has not been mentioned yet is that we work a lot in collaborations and we have lots of meetings. Before, we were traveling a lot. Maybe once a month, we were traveling for meetings and conferences. And now we still meet with people, but through the internet. And we have lots of interactions. And now it doesn't matter where people are. And we interact the same way as people in the US, as the people that were in your office before.
I believe that some people have the notion that, okay, you finished your PhD, you finished your studies. You won't have to study anything anymore. Do you have any idea how much time do you spend a week just reading papers, reading journals about your field?
I would say that definitely less than I would like to. Even if it's the whole day, it's less than I would like to. You learn every day because, as Sergio and Susanna were saying, all the fields are growing very fast and the exoplanet research is not an exception. And if you just look in the internet, the number of papers on the topics that we are working on, it's several dozens of papers. And if you want to do state-of-the-art research, you have to know what is going on around. You have to read all of them. Unfortunately, as Susanna and Sergio were saying, sometimes we don't have enough time to dedicate to this. We learn also a lot while working with students. We learn a lot also from them.
Just to add, it's not only to learn about what is happening in terms of recent news about what people are finding and how do they use the techniques, but also to get up to date with the recent and new technology. Like we are using now Espresso, which is a wonderful machine, but it's just starting. So we have to learn a lot when the instrument is very new. And there's always problems appearing. And actually, we are the only ones that can solve it because we are the only ones that, I'm talking about we, not the three of us, but people that are doing the instrumentation are the best persons to understand how the instrument is evolving and it's working and take the most out of it. So it requires a lot of learning.
We have to learn all the time. We are doing research, so there are new things happening and we have to learn. So we spend a lot of time reading new papers. I would say maybe half a day a week. But as Vardan says, I would like to be much more than that. It's just that we cannot. But we also learn with other people. We learn all the time. Because in any meeting, we learn, we are learning most time.
speaking about papers, this research that we're going to talk about next was published in one of the most prestigious research journals in the world, Nature. Do you remember how did it feel the first time that you had a research published in a journal such as this?
You know, it's exciting to be an author of a Nature paper, but perhaps it's more exciting when you see the results. So I would say, in my opinion, I was more excited about the result than it's going to be published in Nature.
I agree with Vardan. The result that we find is always the most exciting part, but having it published in Nature is very good because it also opened doors for other things. So about Nature, the good thing of Nature is it's more open than a specific journal. But, normally publishing more specific journals, which reach the intended public for us, which is our fellow researchers in the same fields. But Nature, it opens the door for other fields and for other kinds of collaborations also. And in particular for exoplanets, the area, it's very interdisciplinary and it raises a lot of interest in public in general, but also in other areas of science.
I agree with Vardan that sometimes we are more excited about the results. And there's some results that we are very excited about. And maybe there's not many people that care about because it's too specific and they don't get published in Nature, but we are very excited. In this case, it's very interesting and this is still not understood. It's also, we are very proud about it too. But in Nature, you have both things. You're proud about the results and then you're proud that it has been published in a recognized journal.
So let's talk about a little bit about this research in particular. The group found what is believed to be an undressed planet. What is an undressed planet?
We think that this is the nucleus of the planet. The density is too high to have a lot of gas in this planet. And the mass is very high, so it's surprising that we see it without the gas. To call it naked, because we think that there is not an atmosphere in this planet, which is not normal.
What makes this planet, this exoplanet, different from other known exoplanets?
I think being naked makes it different from the others. And as you said, that we believe that it's undressed. I think we still don't know whether this planet was dressed before and got undressed, or it never got dressed. This is the one interesting thing of this planet. So there are, in principle, two possibilities that we heavily discussed in the paper. We believe that this is the core of a massive planet. So there are two options. Either that this core was formed late in the protoplanetary disk and there was no time to accrete some gas to have an atmosphere, or the second possibility is that at the beginning of the formation, this was a giant planet like our Saturn or Jupiter, and then it lost its gaseous envelope, and now it's the only that we see the core of this planet.
Why is it important to study the interior of a giant planet?
This is one more example of stranger things, you know. Since the beginning of the discoveries of exoplanets, we started to find strange bodies. We were familiar with our neighborhood planets in the solar system. We had some theories for their formation. But then suddenly, 20 years ago, we started to find new strange planets that did not fit the planets that we were seeing in our solar system. So the theories that we have developed so far to explain the solar system cannot justify or possibilitate the presence of these strange planets. So we're talking about planets that are very, very close to their host star. They are very, very hot. So this case, as Vardan and Suzanne already explained it, a planet probably that lost or never had an atmosphere. And the physics that we need to explain the solar system also need to explain these planets, these strange planets. And that's why it's interesting to understand the existence of these planets, if they are common or not. This gives us clues to the theories that we have in our paper to see if the puzzle can be filled or not.
In this work, you used data from the TESS Space Telescope. How is TESS different, for example, from KEOPS? And why use ground-based instruments like HARPS? Aren't space telescopes better?
TESS is very different from KEOPS. TESS is looking at several stars at the same time, millions of stars at the same time. While KEOPS is looking at just one. It focuses in just one. TESS is a bit more similar to Kepler than to KEOPS in this case. The difference in between TESS and Kepler is that the TESS is observing a much wider field of view and much brighter stars. And it's very important because the brighter stars give us a much better signal from the star, and we can measure all the quantities that we want to measure with much higher precision. So we can measure the radius, we can measure the mass with a much higher precision. So with TESS, it's much easier to go measure smaller planets, lower mass and lower radius. The part about the space photometry is very important, that the telescopes are in space, because the systematic noise that comes from turbulence in the Earth atmosphere, it makes systematic noise in the light curve, and we cannot reach the precision necessary to see an Earth-sized planet. Sergio already explained, when a planet passes in front of the star, it blocks part of the light, and this is the photometry. We take pictures all the time, and we see the dimming of the light. We need a very high precision to measure an object as small as the Earth to pass in front of a star, and for that we need to go to space. The atmosphere's turbulence is too high for us to do it from the ground. But for the mass, we use spectrographs, and it's huge spectrographs, and to take it to the space, it is not possible at the moment, and we also need a high collecting power, because we divide the light to see all the spectral region, we divide a lot of light. I think maybe Sergio can explain this better. You don't need to go to space for spectra, but you need for photometry.
If we can take spectra in space, that will be very nice, if you can spare me some money. There's two different techniques. So one is clear, is photometry, and we need to get away from the atmosphere, which is a limiting factor for photometry, as Suzanne explained it. And the other is using spectrographs to get the mass, and to detect small planets with these instruments, we need one thing which is very crucial, which is stability. And to have a stable instrument such as this in space, it's not very easy. So that is the main limitation. It's not impossible, but we are talking about probably a crazy amount of money to build such a kind of instrument in space. And we are actually doing pretty well in the ground, so we cannot complain, because the current instrumentation that we have in ground for detecting planets and measuring mass of planets, it's really amazing. And now we are moving to the study of the atmospheres of some planets using these instruments, so which is really impressive.
Okay, so this research was led by the University of Warwick, but it involves 8 researchers from Instituto de Astrofísica e Ciências do Espaço. What exactly was IA's role in this research?
This work includes many researchers working on different areas. You need to study the properties of the planets, properties of the host star, and several details. So one of the things that we did is to very precisely characterize the host star. Chemical composition, stellar parameters, the size, temperature, surface gravity, abundances of different individual elements. And in fact, determination of precise abundances of two, in particular in this case, two elements like magnesium and silicon, was crucial to understand which amount of gas the planets can have. By looking at the chemical composition of the host stars, we could know what is the maximum amount of gas that the planet or the envelope may have. This is one of the important contributions that we have, but this is one of them. I let Susanna and Sergio to comment more, because they did also a lot.
Yes, so there's many people in Porto working in this group, but they are doing slightly different parts of the work, like Vardan said. So some part of us are doing the part of the photometry. In this case, the planet was discovered with the test instrument, and the test has their own pipeline to detect planets, but we also are studying it within the same consortium. We are studying also planets with K2, where in Porto we actually discover the planets. So we reduce the data, we have our own pipeline to reduce the data and then to search for the planets and then to validate the planets and choose the best ones for the follow-up. In this case, we skip the first steps, but we still do a bit of the validations, checking which are the best candidates, seeing from the light curve if it's a real planet or not, because you can never know for sure. You need the radio velocities to confirm the planet candidates from photometry. And then we also help with the data analysis, the analysis of the transit light curve to measure the radius of the planet, the inclination of the system, basically the analysis of the data.
I mean, it's clear that there's a lot of people involved in this work. We work in a collaborative way to achieve these kinds of results. There's no other way to do it. And this starts from the very beginning, to start writing proposals to have access to the instruments, and then going to the instrument, doing the observations, gathering all the data, doing the analysis, Susanna was saying. And as Vardan was saying, he mentioned specific about the chemical composition of the stars. This is very important, the understanding of the stars, because all of these techniques that we use to detect planets are indirect methods. We don't see the planets directly. So we can only infer their presence through the stars. And we mentioned before that we can measure the size of the planets and the mass of the planets. But what we actually get is size of the planet relative to the star and relative mass of the planet relative to the star. So if we don't know the star very well, its size, stellar radius, the stellar mass, we don't know much about the planet also. So it's very important. And part of the work that we've done in this work is to characterize the star. So I was doing the spectral characterization of the star, so we can get what is the temperature, how hot it is in the atmosphere of the star, the chemical composition, as Vardan was saying. So we get these, and then we can also use stellar modelings to track the evolution of the star and understand their mass and their radius, and then infer the real size and the real mass of the planet. This is very crucial.
Okay, so this planet is very odd, but I think the question in all of humanity's mind is, when exactly are we going to find another Earth? Would you care to do an educated guess?
It's very tricky. So either, I mean, we're talking about these two techniques, photometry and radio velocities. And Earth, it's a rather smaller planet, further away from this star. So since we are talking, again, in indirect methods, the perturbation that Earth introduces in the sun are very tiny. So it's very difficult to get this in other stars that are very far away from us. But we are getting closer and closer. We already found smaller planets than Earth, but they are very close to the star. And we are starting to find very similar planets to Earth, a bit more massive, a bit more bigger, but we are getting there, really there. Maybe next week, who knows?
I think I'm an optimist, but next week seems to be a bit too soon. For me, not for Sergio. But as Sergio was saying, that we are getting really ready for that. We have the espresso machine that was built to be able to detect Earth around sun-like star. But we have another mission that IA is deeply involved, and three of us are involved in different groups, which is called Plato, which will launch in 2026 or 2028. Sometimes it's postponed because there is a lot of work to do. And it's one of the goals is to find the Earth-like planets around solar-like stars. Because your question is, when are we going to find the second Earth, it requires a bit more clarification. A planet that looks like Earth, the planet that looks like Earth and has life. But one thing I'm sure that if the planet exists, and I think they should exist, other Earths, we will find them. When I say we, it means that I believe that during my scientific career.
My main research is through photometry, it's transit search. So I am with Vardan. I think that we will need Plato to get another Earth. And yes, 26, it probably will now be more than 28. It will be launched and it will take some time to find it. But it is made to search for another Earth, an Earth-sized planet around an Earth, a sun-like star. So there is a lot of hope that we will be able to find it with Plato and then confirm it and measure its mass. But then this is... In the beginning, this is all we are going to know. It's a planet with what we think would be the right temperature, with the right mass and the right radius. But to know something about the existence of life, I think it will take you much longer than that. But I could be wrong. To next week, some new discovery can appear that will allow us to find a shortcut, and then we will be able to probe life in this planet much faster, and I hope so.
So we all agree, sometime between next week and 2030, something like that.
But Sergio was a bit too sure on his statement. Maybe he knows a bit more than we do next week.
Confidential.
Okay, so you talked about several instruments, several space missions. You've already mentioned TESS, which was used in this research. Also Kepler and K2, which are from NASA. We also talked about KEOPS from the European Space Agency, and even instruments from the European Southern Observatory like ESPRESSO and HARPS. But these are all things that are already either in orbit or already working at the observatories. But IA is involved in several instruments which are currently being developed, like you mentioned Plato. What other instruments or what other space missions is IA involved in?
The other exoplanet mission that we are involved in is Ariel, supposed to study the atmospheres of planets. It will be then maybe be launched in 2028. Originally, it will try to measure the atmospheres of planets a bit bigger than the Earth. So it will not reach Earth-sized planets, but until then, maybe there will be some developments that will help. Also, it needs to planet to be transiting, so it will study, it's through transmission spectroscopy, as the planet passes in front of the star, it measures the difference of spectrum in the planet and the star combined, so we get the spectrum of the planets. And most of the planets, it needs already known planets, and the planets that we know better are the ones that are closer to the star, so are much hotter than what we would like as a habitable planet.
Yeah, and this is for related to the exoplanet research, but IA is involved also in other missions. In IA, we cover not only exoplanet sciences, but also stellar physics, cosmology, galactic astrophysics, and we are involved in several ESA missions and also ESO instruments, like including Athena, IRIS, that will come late in the extremely large telescope for ESO. Again, that is important for exoplanet research on stellar physics and extragalactic astronomy in many things.
Pardon, Susan already mentioned the new instruments to pop up in the next years. Right now, we already have our hands completely full. We are very lucky with ESPRESSO and KEOPS. So we have a lot of groundbreaking data to analyze and to take advantage of it. So, of course, it's always important to be involved in new instrumentation, as we are. But it's also very important to take advantage of what we already have at hand.
I asked this to João Faria in our previous interview, but I would like to have your view in the matter. In 2019, the Nobel Prize for Physics was attributed to the discovery of the first exoplanet around the sun-like star. One of the recipients was, of course, Professor Michel Maillard, which is a collaborator of IAEA's exoplanet group. What was your reaction when you heard about this, and how do you think this impacted the field in general?
I think it was a bit delayed. We have been waiting, I think all exoplanet community have been waiting for this quite a long time, because the discovery is really, it was a start of a new field in astronomy. Since several millennia ago, we had based on philosophical beliefs, we knew that the exoplanets should exist. But this was the first time that it was a demonstration that indeed they exist and we can find them. The impact is difficult to say. Perhaps it will take a bit of time to see real impact of it.
I agree with Varden. I also had the same feeling. We were already expecting it to happen, and for a few years, actually. So it came, in this case, it was already later, but okay. It was a nice, I mean, I can say Nuno was my supervisor, and he was supervised by Michel Maillard, so I am the grandchild of a Nobel Prize, which is nice. I can put that on my CV. In terms of the impact, I think it had a huge, tremendous impact just after the announcement. And now we have to see if that impact will bring something new. I mean, the field has grown very fast, and you can see it by the several missions that we have focused on exoplanet research. So I don't know if the Nobel Prize will increase that, because it's already at high, but at least it will probably maintain this, which is good for us because we are in this field.
I think we're almost finished. I just have one question that I usually ask all of our interviewees, which is, where do you see yourself in 5 years?
Then I think in 5 years, we will have PLATO almost ready. We will be extremely busy with finding the second Earth if Sergio doesn't find it next week. I hope if in 5 years we have an interview, we will speak about something that we cannot imagine now. Like, are we sure there is life on that planet or not? At least that's the hope that I have.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's like I told before, this field is evolving very, very fast. So in 5 years, it's too long to know and to predict what will happen. So maybe we won't find the Earth next week, but maybe in 2 weeks. But in 5 years, I don't know. I mean, right now, things are changing. Before, we were focused, and we still are, but we were more focused on the detection of new planets. And now we already have a huge number of new detections, so more than 4,000. And now clearly the instrumentation is changing, not only to detect, but also for the characterization. And I'm seeing now a lot of things happening in the characterization of atmospheres of planets. And I think this will give very interesting results now. As before, we were detecting massive planets and trying to detect smaller and smaller planets until we finally reach Earth-like planets, hopefully in the near future. For the characterization of the planets, it will happen the same way. Right now, we are already starting to characterize the atmospheres of giant planets, hot Jupiters. And with the new instrumentation, we will start going to the smaller planets and eventually go to Earth-like planets to study the atmospheres. And there will be a lot of unbelievable things to discover.
Yes, like Vardin, I know the deadline for PLATO will be very soon in 5 years, and I will probably be very, very busy with the last minute preparations. But I also hope that we still have KEOPS, and it will still be working, and if there is an extension for KEOPS, we will still have it. And by then, hopefully, we'll have found the first exoplanet moon or rings, so we will be very busy also trying to model them and understanding them and comparing them with the ones that we already have in the solar system.
Okay, so that's it for the interview. I'd like to thank my three guests, Vardan, Sergio, Susana. Thank you very much, and I hope you enjoy it.